Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. This is episode 9. Holy hell, we're still on the airwaves or whatever internet waves this is. I'm your host, Wade Bojic, joined by David Ishida.
Hello, everyone.
And the latest, the greatest, Ben Robertson.
The best version yet.
Yep. He's upgraded. We have the technology. So today is a really cool episode. We're going to be talking about external monitors for cameras. Very overlooked part of the production process, I would say. And then tricks of the trade, using obsolete tech to get an artistic look from a bygone era. That is actually something I'm really excited to talk about. As highlighted by the Oscar-nominated... Did it win?
Did she...
I don't remember. We'll look it up. There was nothing the Oscar-nominated Jackie. And then finally, instead of a new film this month, we're looking at and talking about Blade Runner, the cyberpunk classic, I'll say.
Oh, yeah.
Noir.
Kind of noir. Kicking it right off here. I talk about it almost every episode, but when shooting Dawn, we used an external monitor. Do you know which one that was, David?
Yes, we were using the Small HD DP7 Pro. Okay.
And we'll be talking about two this episode. One more affordable, and the Small HD is going to be a little more expensive one. Let's first talk about the cheaper one and then kind of move into...
And one other thing I want to throw in real quick first, a distinction to keep in mind when you're dealing with camera monitors or camera monitoring the video feed, something other than a LCD that's like built onto the camera or an EVF or electronic viewfinder. There's sort of two categories that we break them into. We're looking at either production monitors or onboard or on-camera monitors. The... One of the big distinctions is tends to be the size. On-camera monitors tend to be 10 inches or less in size, and then production monitors tend to be, for the most part, 17 inches or larger.
And you find that in the Video Village or whatever?
Yes, that's where you... So the production monitor is one that would be for the director or a cinematographer or the other crew to be watching on, or clients, if you're doing something like commercial for a client. And then the onboard would be ones for the AC and the camera operator.
Gotcha. The cheaper one, the FNV Medica FM7. That's a long name.
It's kind of a mouthful.
That goes for $429, and it's, would you say, a good introductory monitor?
Yes, and having a monitor, an onboard monitor, larger than an LCD is important. If anyone has shot on a DSLR, you know, trying to judge focus on the little 3-inch screen is a huge challenge.
It's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I know, Ben, you've had to deal with that recently with some of the stuff you've been shooting.
Lots of frustration.
Just as a point of reference, when we shot Dawn Teaser 2, we had, on the first day of shooting, when we were filming Trav kind of at the end of the teaser, he was looking off in the distance. It was, I would say, a medium close-up, and we had autofocus on our Sony camera. It autofocused to the trees behind Trav, but we weren't able to tell because of the small screen, the small onboard viewfinder.
Absolutely.
And that's what we use these tools for, is to try and, well, that's one of the uses.
Because everything looks good on that LCD, but the moment that you bring it into post, it just, you're like, shit.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Because of, you know, you get, it's smaller resolution, but it's more compressed, I guess. So anything looks better on a smaller screen resolution-wise.
Absolutely. And this FNV, so this is a company that started out by making relatively inexpensive lights, LED lights. And this monitor, I've seen some versions of this one, and for the price, it is very sharp. It has a decent amount of brightness to it. One other cool thing that I like is that there's most monitors of this size have a sun hood of some kind, you know, block glare from the sun. And this one, most of the time, it's a soft, like, you know, a nylon material hood. This one has a hard plastic one.
Yeah.
And when you folds up, it's a protector for the screen, so it folds down over the screen, which is nice because you don't want to scratch or damage the LCD itself.
It looks really nice. I think we've used soft ones before. It's for the Phantom drone, right?
Yes,
it was like a soft screen.
Exactly.
This one looks well put together. Would you say that is it an older design, or is it just more rugged? The corners look a little. Kind of like your phone case. They look cool.
There's these nubs on the corners of it. And I think part of that is, I believe, as I recall, that's partially where the sun hood clips onto. It uses those. And another thing that those could be used for is if you drop it, it goes to that corner because that's sticking out. And it will dent the corner before it dents something more important closer towards the middle.
Is it also for mounting?
Those corners wouldn't be no, but on this one, I believe there are four mounting spots on it. One top, one bottom, one left, one right.
Sure.
And they're all quarter 20 size, which is a standardized size for mounting equipment. One thing to look at, to consider when you're looking at these kinds of monitors, a lot of people, they you go into getting a monitor like this wanting it to be more than like a full HD, which is somewhat of a fallacy. Because to get full HD on a screen that size is very expensive.
Interesting.
You're talking about a small 7-inch or 5-inch screen. Getting it to full HD is expensive, and it would make it probably a $2,000 monitor to do that well.
Are we talking 720 or are we talking 1080?
1080.
Okay.
1080. Full HD. Mm-hmm.
There is an app for the iPad mini, I'm assuming, and regular iPad that you can get. We're not going to really go into today, but I've seen it on film sets before, and it basically takes a signal from a transmitter from the camera.
Yep, a Teradek Cube.
That's the one.
Yep. And wireless video transmission will be for another time, as that's becoming more and more important to be untethered. But like for this one, for this FNV, the actual resolution of the screen is 1024 by 600. And then what it does is it's taking the 1080 signal and it's basically putting it down into that constraints. But it looks great.
Yeah.
You can still judge focus off of it easily. It's not vital to have it be full HD when it's this size. If you're going up to a production monitor, you know, one of the larger ones, then it's probably a little more important, especially if you have clients that you probably want to see it in HD.
I'm curious, David. We talked about two cameras earlier on 2016 when we did our camera episode, the Canon XF105 and the Canon C300. Mm-hmm. Would this one work well with an HDMI input for the 105?
Yes. And one thing to keep in mind for those cameras is there's the 100 and the 105. The only difference between those two models is an SDI. The 105 has SDI, the 100 does not. If you're buying one of those, you can save about $200 if don't want
it. And this does have SDI, so you could use it.
Yep, so this one has both HDMI and SDI. And that's another thing when you're looking at these monitors, to look at your camera. So, you know, if you're using a DSLR, you probably don't need SDI because DSLRs don't have SDI. So you can probably save yourself, you know, maybe about $100 if you don't have SDI on it. But if you want something that you can use far into the future, that if you want to be able to keep it to a camera you could get in the near future, you may want to just spend the extra $100 to get one that has both.
Yeah.
So a question, how are these being powered then?
Is it
being powered off of the camera? Does it have its own battery? How does that work?
It is rarely powered off of the camera itself for the most part. Like with this FNV one, we have it powered off of, I believe, the Sony NPF line of batteries. Or you can do it via what's called PTAP, which is another kind of power connection. We don't need to go into that.
Yeah,
into
but that's like high-end professional batteries, right?
Sort of. It's a type of connector that is on some of the higher-end professional batteries, and it's sometimes on cameras. But that one, again, it's something that you need to have a high enough end camera or setup to utilize something like PTAP.
The good thing about this battery, it uses the Sony one. I think it's a pretty common Sony battery.
It's very common.
The Sony camera we used earlier before we got the Blackmagic and before we used DSLRs used that same battery. So it's nice to be able to get, I don't know, whatever Sony you're using and be able to use the same batteries using on the camera on this monitor.
Mm-hmm. Don't our light panels use them too?
Yes, they do.
Interesting.
And that's another thing with it is, even if you don't have another Sony camera where you're using the same batteries, the nice thing about this particular line of Sony is everybody and their cousin makes this battery.
Okay.
So you can find them very cheap and find them all over the place. You know, buying a name brand Sony one could put you back $100, but like FNV makes a version of this battery that works just as well, and it's like $50.
Interesting.
Or $40.
Gotcha. You could use them on the camera then if you used a Sony, but maybe it wouldn't work as well.
Yeah, it depends. Some Sonys tend to be particular about those because it needs to be a smart battery, one that actually has a microchip in it that will communicate certain information to the camera.
Gotcha. And then we have the small HD 702 Lite, which goes for $899, a little more expensive. And we actually did order a small HD, but then we returned it because it didn't go full screen for some reason when we hooked it up to my DSLR. This was way back in this was years ago.
Oh, yeah. I'd completely forgotten about that.
Yeah.
On newer ones, that's another thing. If you are doing DSLR video work, the way that DSLRs output a signal is a bit weird because it punches the image in and then it leaves information all around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
And some monitors are capable of acknowledging there's useless black space around an image and blowing it up. Newer small HDs account for that.
Oh,
now.
Wait, no, I'm sorry. We didn't actually get a small HD. I think it was like a Marshall or something. It was a different brand.
Oh, okay.
And small HD we wanted to get because it counteracted that.
Okay, yeah, you're right. Yeah, and for these new ones, like if you whether you use Nikon or Panasonic or Canon DSLRs, mm-hmm. it has special settings to blow it up so you get the maximum real estate for the actual image.
Yeah, so this new line, I say new because it looks sleek and new age.
Yeah, I think this line started 2 years ago, I think, is when mm-hmm. the 500 series and the 700 series.
So this
small HD came
this one
out.
Has a technically HD resolution of 1280 by 800 or 720 active.
Mm-hmm.
And again, has HDMI and SDI as well. But what sets it apart from the FNV?
The main thing you'll see here, one is build quality will be a huge difference. The small HD prides themselves on their build quality, and these ones are really well made. It's an all aluminum interior frame, and then it's a rubberized exterior, so it can take a fall really well.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And yeah, it's really well built. And also, you'll probably see the overall quality of the image will be a lot better. You know, you're paying almost double the price for this one. And you'll see that it'll probably have better contrast ratios, you know, the contrast between white and black. Obviously, the resolution is a bit better. It's probably brighter as well. This one is 450 nits. Nits being a measurement of light output.
It just makes me think of Monty Python.
Yeah.
Holy Grail.
The Knights that say nits.
Yeah.
Which image is it grabbing? If I were to hook this up to my DSLR, is it grabbing the viewfinder image or is it grabbing the LCD image?
Now, keep in mind, in a DSLR, the viewfinder image is not a video.
Correct.
On a DSLR, it's reflected. Yeah. You're actually seeing through the lens. So it's grabbing the image that would normally be going to the LCD screen.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a good question, though, Ben, because I have a Canon T3i, and hooking that up to any HDMI monitor would basically just blow up everything I'm seeing on the viewfinder.
Mm-hmm.
So that can get distracting, I guess.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. it doesn't look good if you're, say, you wanted to use it for like live streaming or something because you got all that information on screen.
Yep. The two other really nice things about the small HD when you go up to this is one thing is that it has two battery slots on it. So with a monitor like this, you don't need both. You can run off of one battery, but then you get the convenience of having two.
Kind of like our light monitor, our light panels.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. And the other nice thing is that it does what's called cross conversion. And so because this one, it has SDI and HDMI in. So say you're using a DSLR camera, you're going HDMI into the monitor, but you are doing a bigger production, you need to run to an SDI monitor for clients, a production monitor. It is much, you know, SDI carries a signal farther, better.
Right.
You know, you can go 700 feet on SDI and not have a problem in the most part, but you go over 25 feet on HDMI and then the signal's destroyed.
Does anyone go 700 feet? Wouldn't you go wireless at that point?
Yes, for a production. Like in building installations, they definitely can go that far.
Oh, sure.
But so with this one, with the cross conversion, if you do HDMI in from your camera, there's a processor on there that will convert the signal to SDI so you can go out of the monitor through a pass-through as SDI to go to another monitor.
Okay, so that starts to explain the $899 price point a little bit more.
Yep. SDI, you know, that's why, as I mentioned, with the cameras or with the monitors, as soon as you add SDI, because there are very specific standards that have to be adhered to when they're from the manufacturers and the manufacturer standpoint, that's why the price jumps whenever you get SDI, which is why, you know, it's so much more widely accepted in the professional world because it's a very robust signal and system to use versus HDMI.
Just renting out equipment, what do you see professionals use? Do they go towards small HD? Do they go towards something entirely different?
Small HD has been a very popular one because while it is expensive, it is still very reasonable for what you're getting out of it. If you're going to higher end ones, then you're getting into like another level, like TV Logic is another brand. For that one, to get a 5-inch TV Logic, you'll spend $1,400 to get a 5-inch one.
Wow. Yikes.
But, you know, for that, you know, you're getting an amazing looking image. And the panel looks fantastic, the image panel.
That's really cool. Well, like, there's a lot more to dive into for future episodes. You've got, like we talked about earlier, the Teradek on the iPad. We could go into, you know, the giant Video Village monitors that we have on C-stands and stuff, mm-hmm. which, again, we did use at some point when shooting Cinequipped, which was awesome. But we got to move on to Tricks of the Trade, obsolete technology for an artistic look. Be right back. I can't remember the last time I shot on VHS, but it's amazing that people still do that or can do that.
Yeah.
If they choose. Freddie W. from Rocket Jump made a 90s commercial that looked like it was on VHS. Of course, it wasn't. But what was their technique when they did that?
So when they did that, as Wade mentioned, they're looking for this aesthetic, this every 90s commercial ever. And what they did is they shot in the best that at the time technology had to offer. They were shooting on a Red Epic at 6K resolution. Jeez. And then rather, you know, there's ways you can achieve the look with different filters or effects that you could buy to overlay digitally onto the image. But what they did is they just passed the signal through a VCR.
That's crazy.
And then recorded the output. And so that's how they got their, you know, the scan lines and the tracking at the bottom.
I don't know if you guys have seen this. There's a chart I found maybe 10 years ago now online that shows the relative resolution, right, of all these different formats. So you've got Red 8K or whatever on the far end, and then it goes into like 4K and then HD 1080 and then 720, and then way in the inside is your standard def or your substandard def, your VHS. And it's crazy just how many orders of magnitude the resolution is between VHS and something like Red 8K or something like that. It's insane. But as we mentioned earlier, Jackie, a film that was up for an Oscar this year at the Academy Awards, used Super 16 to film some of their more documentary style sequences.
Well, I think they used it though for the, did they use it for the whole thing?
I think it was a mix between 35 and Super 16.
Yeah, and I think that's been used before, and I did not get to see it, but what I'm guessing they did is for elements that were around the assassination moment, because all the footage we have, the actual footage from the assassination of JFK, is Super 16.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what they go for when they're using it at those moments to capture that same feeling.
I wonder if they use actually real footage. Like at any point, do they use captured footage?
Yeah.
From back then. I wonder. I mean, I don't know.
We are at the disadvantage of not dissecting the film, having not seen it. But but that is a good point. Anyway, when I first saw the clip they showed at the Academy Awards, was incredible. I recognized it almost immediately as having that look of Super 16. Mm-hmm. I was so familiar with it from film school because we use those cameras. And I so appreciated that specific look, because that is such a deliberate artistic choice to go after that. And it was immediately juxtaposed with a shot from La La Land, and it was worlds apart from like the look. I mean, La La Land had this new, crisp, probably digital red look that is so different from that nice, warm, grainy Super 16
absolutely
that we saw. And, you know, where things are kind of drifting in and out of focus, very documentary-like, which a lot of documentaries were shot in Super 16 back before digital. So that makes sense. You see, I think it was Film History, we watched a documentary on the Civil Rights Movement where to catch focus, a lot of times they would zoom in all the way to someone, set focus, and then zoom all the way out.
Yep.
With those special lenses that don't drift as you zoom out on focus. Mm-hmm. But that was really cool.
Yeah, and another good example of this is when you're going through present, you know, in the film's narrative, present and flashback. One that came out a few years ago, Blue Valentine. It's a Ryan Gosling romantic film. And for that one, all the present day in the narrative stuff was shot on a red one, so nice crisp digital image, 4K, and then all of the flashbacks were shot in Super 16. So you get a strong distinction between the present and the past as represented through the visual aesthetic of digital and then film.
I think that works really well. Another example I just thought of, you guys have seen 500 Days of Summer. They use, in the very beginning, there is a montage of them growing up, Summer and the main character's name, whose name escapes me right now. Anyway, that guy, let me know if you think of it, guys, because it's really bugging me now. But Jay was going to look it up. Anyway, they used, I'm pretty sure it was High 8, because it did have that more grainy than Super 16 look. And it might have been just, you know, their editing, but the aspect ratio was more 4:3. And anyway,
Tom. Thanks. Played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yes. I did know his name. I'm more curious, though, maybe you should look this up, David, is if they used actual home video or home film footage from those two actors when they were young. Because it looks like Joseph Gordon-Levitt when he's little. So I wonder if they just like say, hey guys, do you guys have any home movies we can use?
It looks like in this real quick search, it looks like it was not.
So they just found kids that looked like him. Interesting. So that would be a good example then of them using old technology for a specific style.
Mm-hmm. And one thing though that is important to keep in mind, because this can be a very powerful aesthetic and to make very strong statement juxtapositions between either periods or feelings you're trying to get across.
Yeah.
But yet there's also the challenges with doing this you have to keep in mind. If you want to, for example, shoot on Hi8, as one of the Sundance films of this year, As You Are, was shot on, for there were scenes, the movie goes back and forth as a coming of age story between these narrative parts that were they shot with anamorphic glass, so very cinematic looking, and then cut to, throughout the film, there are these police depositions that are happening, and those were all shot on Hi8. And they talk about how, even as they're trying to capture this Hi8 footage into a computer, the tape is practically falling apart.
Okay.
So there are all these challenges you have to keep in mind. Like, if you're going to use some of these, like, how are you going to capture it? Because, you know, for example, even Mini DV, which is something our first Sony camera used.
Yeah.
With that one, you know, by the end of our lifespan of using it, we were starting to run into fewer and fewer of the professional editing programs were even able to detect that kind of tape-based capture. You know, if we really wanted to do it now in the future, we'd have to go to a duplication service or something that has a proper deck and then special software to interface that into a recorder on a computer.
And those decks aren't cheap either. I remember we were looking into buying one for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, there were a couple grand or something.
Yeah, I think the ones for the low-end DV ones were probably about $5,000. $4,000 or $5,000 for those.
For that sweet, sweet standard def.
Oh, yeah.
Ours was HD, but we never really thought that we could actually get HD out of it either, though.
There were a lot of problems with the camera.
Do you guys think it's weird that it's still called standard def and high def?
Yeah.
At what point is standard def just going to be like, nope, that's not standard anymore?
That's a good question.
Because it's not the standard.
Well, it's all marketing at this point, because now you have ultra high def.
Yep. And ultra high def is even worse, because technically the UHD or ultra high definition standard covers everything between 4K and 8K.
Really?
Yeah.
It's
really weird. So, like, you know, one day, like, I want to buy an 8K movie, like, in 5 years. Okay, I need UHD, but then, like, we'll just say UHD, and you need to try and find where it says a resolution on it. Anyway.
It makes me wonder, let's say, 100 years from now, what filmmakers, if they're still around, are going to do to get the look of, let's say, today. Like, oh man, we want to get that old Red or Alexa style look, which is weird because that's just like how things look to us now. Like, that's normal.
Right.
Imagine
wanting to backdate to this.
This is really interesting. I watched Lord of the Rings Fellowship of the Ring right after the first Hobbit movie came out, and for the first time I was struck at a slightly dated look for the film. It was the scene where I was comparing when Gandalf goes to Hobbiton in the beginning of both films.
Yep.
And how, like, crisp and colorful and low high contrast, but anyway, how more fantastical and new and digital the Hobbit one looked versus the Fellowship. And I can show you guys after the podcast, but if you compare the shots of Gandalf as he's standing at the door of Bag End, it looks old, like old in the Fellowship.
Interesting.
Looks good. It looks good.
So interesting, because I thought about this, because I actually enjoy the Lord of the Rings movies much more than the Hobbit does, as most people think I do.
Yeah.
I think do. But one of the things I thought was interesting is that the effects in the Lord of the Rings movies seem more real, or I question them less than I do The Hobbit. And I wonder if that's because that it's either like a lower grade, so I'm not looking, or maybe it's done better. I don't know. But like, if I find that I don't see those special effects as much if I'm watching a DVD quality of them.
In general, I would agree. There are a couple standout moments in Fellowship in particular that are kind of
as bad though as using a GoPro in The Hobbit.
Oh my God, cringe.
Yeah. But I think you guys can remember the moment in the Bridge of Khazad-dûm before the bridge, when they're going down the stairs and Aragorn and Frodo have to jump off the stairs. And there's that very awkward shot where they're kind of like, lean forward, and they're like drifting towards the camera. And it's like, all right, green screen guys with a fan. I see what's going on here. But excellent use of miniatures, excellent use of a combination of miniatures and digital figures, especially when they're crossing the bridge, like the crane shot of going over the bridge, over the miniature with the composited digital people running.
Yep.
Stuff like that is great because it's the perfect blend where it doesn't matter that it's fake. It's telling the story properly. I think it's a weird counter argument I hear from, I think, people in the industry who say, who cares if it's fake? It's all fake. It's just telling a story. And I'm like, I agree. If it's effective and it doesn't distract and take me out of the story, mm-hmm. like it does more in the Hobbit films than it does Lord of the Rings. Yeah. If it's noticeably CGI to the point where I'm just like, this doesn't feel real to me, then yes, I will call it out and say it's a bad use of it. And I think most people agree with that. They just can't articulate what makes CGI so bad when it is. You know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. a lot of times it's used effectively and very well.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's one of those moments when it stands out and hits you with it that it's bad. Or like a good example of a good blending is Mad Max.
Yeah, and we did talk about this in an earlier episode, yeah. and we're getting a little bit off topic.
Yeah.
But anyway, I am getting back to the point. I am really curious what people are going to do 100 years from now to get, if they want to get the old look of 2017.
They're going to give a 2D image. It's just going to be 2D. Like you're going to be in your virtual world. And all you're showing is just this flat image.
See, I don't know, man. I don't think things are going to go that crazy. Like in Back to the Future 2, when he goes to 2015, and the
Jaws 17, Jaws, or whatever.
And 19, has this 19. Giant shark hologram, which is cool. And yeah, like
shark we still looks fake.
Experiment with that stuff today. But like, look at, again, more off topic, but whatever. Look at Microsoft with their hologram headset thing. Do you guys see that when that was announced?
The HoloLens?
Is that what it was called?
Are you talking about augmented reality versus virtual reality?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was the HoloLens.
That was what, like a year, 2 years ago when they announced that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what happened with that? It's kind of like Google Glass, where it was like, all right, goodbye.
Yeah, I would imagine
well,
they're probably still putting
money
into it.
The, yeah, the, yeah, they. I think they just announced a replacement, an update to that. Just happened.
Could you guys imagine getting out of bed? All right, I'm going to wake up, put on my hologram helmet, and walk out of the house.
Well, eventually we won't need a helmet. It'll just be a chip behind your eye.
An iPhone?
Well, that does kind of segue into the life of a dystopian future where we all have access to better technology, but we also are living in the seething other underbelly of a class-based society in Blade Runner, which we will talk about now after this. So back in the early 80s when Harrison Ford was just the big actor in Hollywood. He was just
he was big man on campus.
He was the shit. He was the big man on campus. Anyway, he was the star in Blade Runner, which is quintessentially the go-to cyberpunk film, I would say.
Mm.
When I think about dystopian futures with technology.
That's what I wonder if it is. I don't know. I need to see like a Merriam-Webster's definition of dystopian. Because I don't know if I'd call that a dystopian future.
Well, oh, I would. Let's debate that.
Oh, okay.
It is very dystopian. You've got a huge class divide between the underclass and the upper class. And everyone has access to this great technology, but people are very cutthroat, and it's always dark and dingy, film noir style, but it's darker than normal film noir. Like,
we're getting off of dystopian future. We're talking about dystopian.
Okay, but when all I'm saying is when people say cyberpunk, they think dystopian and they think Blade Runner. Okay, so.
And question though, when you were describing dystopian, I think you were confused. I think you're talking about this year. Ayo.
All right.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, the reason why I asked us to talk about Blade Runner this episode as opposed to a newer film is because I hadn't seen it, first mm-hmm. of all, and I'd heard a lot about it and wanted to make a point to finally look at it with respect to a new game that's going to be coming out sometime soon, Cyberpunk 2077.
Well, the next CD Projekt Red.
Yeah, which they and the designer of the Cyberpunk tabletop RPG credit as like, they credit Blade Runner as being like the foundation essentially of what we think of as cyberpunk.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And they also say dystopian, but anyway, but okay, we watched it. I want to know what you guys think of this movie.
So I rewatched it. I a couple things come to mind. I think it's very pretty. There's a lot of really well done shots that I love. Just with the work of the lighting and everything, like everything's just so dark.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge contrast between all the neon lighting and all there's like no natural lighting at all, or very rare. Or whenever there is a little bit, Deckard says like, "Hey, can you make it darker?" which is all very interesting to
me.
As far as just whether I liked it in general, I really enjoy this movie. I enjoy the whole noir genre. I guess I can go more into it, but let's hear what you think,
David.
I love this film. I love this. This is probably one of my, at this point, one of my top fives. When I think of the phrase "every frame a painting," this is one of the movies that comes into my mind. That the intentionality of every shot, the way that it beautifully melded the sci-fi dystopian future with the all the nuances that you expect out of an old 1920s film noir. It was blended beautifully, and it didn't take away from either genre to put them together. I think the story is wonderful. I think the certain degree of ambiguity at the ending, which is something that I do want to make sure we talk about too. The beautiful, like each character is that the epitome of like the tropes of noir. You have the dark detective character. You have a beautiful femme fatale.
Not only the detective character, but the detective character who is sort of on the edge of the police force. Mm-hmm. Like he used to be part of them, but he's retired and he's being pulled back into the force one last time.
Yep,
that whole thing. And like you said, the femme fatale and others.
And the music also is wonderful. And Ben and I were talking before the podcast how this is one of the most sampled movie soundtracks ever for its for the use of the. It was done by an artist. Vangelis, I think, I don't know how you say it, was the composer for it. It's this wonderful, you know, synthy music that also captures both the old film noir and the cyberpunk.
So really 80s well. Reminds me of Pink Floyd's album, the Something Bell. God, it's their 80s album talking about the end of the Cold War, but they use a lot of the same synths.
Well, it's interesting, and they do have a nice sax or like the equivalent kind of thing in there to kind of bring in some of the more moody.
Yeah, and another a great thing. Connection that I see to it is one of my favorite video games of all time.
I was gonna say this ODST is why you like ODST so much.
Is Let's Finish the Circle.
Yeah, I did like it. It's essentially like a got a cult following, right? And so I think I felt about this film like maybe audiences would have felt initially seeing it in theaters, not really sure what to think at first. But it's a film that takes some time to dissect into it.
Absolutely.
But also at the same time, this many years after its release, we have this, it's developed this stigma, I guess, as this great master classic or whatever. So I kind of expected that too. Expecting it to be, you know, way up here and feeling about it a little bit more here didn't make me feel disappointed, but I definitely want to look into it more. I will say it is so clear to me all the influences it's had.
Yep.
For absolutely. Example, not only in just film, but in video games as well. Deus Ex, the reboot.
Absolutely.
The 2009, I believe, or 2011, somewhere around there, by Eidos Montreal. They go into, I for work, I interviewed them, and the artistic director talked about the Renaissance paintings playing into the color scheme, and it's about the Renaissance of man and about how they painted by candlelight and had to use these warmer tones. I'm just like, no, you just saw Blade Runner. Like, you dispense with all this bullshit about your highbrow artistic inspirations. You saw Blade Runner and you were like, I want that in this game. Because it's so, the color scheme is black and gold, or black and like that amber color. Yep.
And Deus Ex.
Deus Ex, yeah.
Yep. Yep.
It's so well known. Deus Ex, the reboot from Eidos, is so well known for that color scheme because effectively, like watching Blade Runner, I was like, yep, there it is. But a lot of other films I feel like took from it as well. It's so clear to me to see it as that starting point for a lot of different ideas. To the point of David saying every frame of painting, I agree. So many shots are set up very well. It was so nice to see a film like this take its time and set up scenes kind of a little bit more slowly. This was, in my opinion, so needed in Force Awakens, but it wasn't there.
Yeah.
There wasn't that nice, slow, beautiful setup to some scenes, with the exception of, I would say,
the beginning of Jakku. It's kind of
like that's the one exception.
Yeah. Well, and I also love, you know, again, with the shots they use and all these things that they're doing to set up future elements and they how when they set them up early, like, you know, the early stuff, like the opening scene being the Voight Kampff test, mm-hmm. and the eyes, and then all the eyes you see later, you see the importance of the owl's eyes.
Yeah.
Keeps flashing, which is another interesting thing if we want to talk about in how it relates to the book, because there's a reason for that in the book series, because okay. there's a series of book in the that it's based on. And also the what's the actor's name? Edward James Olmos' character, his like a deputy or whatever he is, and he has his little origami figures.
Oh,
or
yeah, the guy with
man.
The fedora who follows him around.
Yep,
very classic noir, by the way. Yep. Having that in the movie,
absolutely. Yeah, and you know he has his little origami things, especially the all important one at the very, very
right.
end.
Oh, are we jumping to the end right now?
Is no, we don't happening? Have to. But I just want to point
I,
out,
I did love the thing with the eyes. By the way, I thought that was really yep. cool.
So I wanted to resonate with you a little bit, Wade, as far as not sure what being. Not sure what to think about yeah, when you yeah, first see it yeah. because when I first watched this film I was much younger. I think I was like probably like around like 15 or 16, maybe 17, and the movie didn't really make much sense to me. Like from a setting wise it was really cool, but I did not understand the plot. I didn't really understand like what was. I understood that Harrison Ford is, you know, a Blade Runner, whatever that is, and that he's going to kill these people. But I never really understood like why he was doing that or whatever. And I remember watching it last night, and so much more of it made sense to me. And I don't know if that's because I was older if it was because the second time I was watching it.
Yeah.
But I definitely appreciated it more the second time around yeah. than I did the first time.
One thing that I was confused about, and it made a little more sense once I read the Wikipedia article, was why, and it leads to the ambiguity at the end, but why does Harrison Ford's character, God, what is his name again?
Deckard.
Rick Deckard.
Why does Deckard agree to take this case? He's like, no, I'm not going to do it. He's like, well, you got no choice. Oh, okay, I'll do it.
I think it's because in that conversation, he says that you're either like working for us and you're a part of this upper class, or you're just down and below, which I think goes more to the dystopian stuff, the caste system that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. So you're either a part of the system working for it, and you're lifted up a little bit, or if you're not, then you're just in the lowest.
I don't know. It seemed like he was content with where he was before he got brought in.
I think that, again, there's maybe it may play into the ambiguity of it. But also, I wonder if in the noir vein, it's those veiled threats that people make, you know, that yeah. a Godfather would make. Like, I'm not saying that something bad would happen to you, but, you know, if you're not on the side of us, you know, then you're a suspect.
You got
or
a
whatever.
Nice place here. It'd be yeah. awful if something would have happened to it. No, I it's a small gripe. I kind of took it as it was, as like a veiled threat, essentially. Mm. I did like the compassion test a lot, or the empathy test.
Yep, the Voight Kampff, as they call it
yeah,
in the series.
Yeah, that was very interesting. And I guess, was there supposed to be uncertainty as to whether or not Rachel was a replicant? Because I took it as she was immediately.
No, yeah, she, yeah. and yeah, Wayland, not Wayland.
Yeah. You're thinking of Alien right now.
Well, and it was the same universe.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, Ridley Scott said
get the hell
so,
out of here.
Yeah, I know this makes it all crazy. Yeah, so it's all connected. Alien and Blade Runner are the same universe because this Wayland is they buy Tyrell because it's the Wayland Tyrell Corporation okay. in Alien, and this is Tyrell in this one.
So hold on. So just real quick,
this blue. I'm so this like I can yeah. see your mind explode right
brief,
now. With
this
that.
Was new to me too.
Brief aside, what does this take place before or after Alien?
This would be before Alien. Before Alien. This took this takes place. This year, next year, what was it? 2019. So sure. That's when Blade Runner was, and
so then
Alien is 21 something.
So then, sometime after Blade Runner, Prometheus takes place.
Yes, yep, and then yeah, at that point, and that one's Wayland.
Yeah,
and so yeah, that's
it kind of makes me sad a little bit because then with that in mind, I'm sure that Ridley Scott just had this great universe in mind that he was building that was taken away from him, and James Cameron was like, all right, my turn.
Yeah,
and but he's bringing it back though. The next Alien movie.
That's going to be another. That's going to be a topic yeah, for another yeah. time.
So that's really cool. I didn't know that, but it did feel not old because '80s isn't like old Hollywood, but it's in its storytelling. It felt more traditional to me.
Very. It does adhere to the hero's journey. You know, there's the call to adventure, the denial. They do go to adventure anyway. You know, all those themes.
So then, where does Where does this fit in the framework? The scene where he like basically sexually assaults her. Where does that fit in there?
That's noir.
Okay.
That's noir.
That's your classic noir.
That's classic. Well, it really is that scene. Yeah, as I said, it brings across the noir films so well. I think it does noir better than some noir
Getting
films
all
do
these
noir.
Rapey vibes in this noir film. Yeah.
I thought that
there
too.
Are. It comes with the femme fatale character. That kind of thing does happen.
I do wonder where her agency is, because she's so expressionless throughout the whole film, with the exception of when she rescues Deckard. That mm-hmm. you can see her agency, but it might be self preservation too, because mm-hmm. she understands that he's like her biggest ally. She understands that he's like her biggest ally.
Yep. And another thing, also real quick, as we talked about in the last segment about visual effects, this movie is considered some of the greatest visual effects,
yeah.
and it looks so good.
I was very impressed.
You watch it now and it looks amazing.
I love the hovering cop car. I think that's mm-hmm. done very well.
Which also, a quick side note, also that was recently restored by fans. That original
nice.
Cop car, they found that and they just recently restored it.
Yeah. So yeah, I totally agree. The effects, the matte paintings, the
models, the everything.
I was confused why they said it was LA, because the giant pyramids, I don't think, says L.A. to me.
Well, you know, it's the future. It's 2019.
Yeah.
But they have 2 more years to finish those pyramids.
So the guy who made Cyberpunk, though, the tabletop RPG, that he made it, I think, in 88, used, I think, heavily from Blade Runner, their style. But it takes place in Night City, which is in between L.A. and San Francisco. So it's a fictional city that mm-hmm. has a lot of the same elements.
Mm-hmm.
The dark, you know, rainy, dingy, yep. dystopian.
Mm-hmm. And also with that, you know, because there you don't see anything to identify it as L.A. And one interesting thing is you don't see the ocean.
Yeah, or palm trees or anything.
You don't see these things. But one thing I love about it is, as you were talking about earlier, it takes its time. It's slow
mm-hmm.
at times, but it doesn't feel slow when you're watching. Mm-hmm. Like, there's all these, and the music makes it go well. Like, the opening shot when you're coming up to the Tyrell Corporation pyramids, and it's that slow 80s synth sound, and it's just that slow moving in,
yeah.
and then it cuts in and it's a little bit closer.
So I'm gonna
love that pacing.
I'm gonna contest you a little bit as far as it not being iconic LA, because as a person who has lived in California, in SoCal, like if you go anywhere up into the foothills or the mountains and you look off into the distance, all of the yellow lights that you see that are on desert, the opening shot, all the lights that are out like that, that is very much LA and very much like SoCal.
Okay, that's cool. That's fair. Yeah.
But I loved some of the thematic elements, where the most powerful and dangerous replicants that come back to the head of the corporation to try and get more time, they show a very important theme about kind of like what makes us human, I guess.
What makes it, what we do with the time. You know, one thing that
No, sorry. That wasn't my point. My point was that It highlights a uniquely human trait, or dolphin or ape or whatever, but like the fear of death.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
The fear of death is also present in these replicants, and they want to live longer. And he says, the spark that burns the brightest also burns the quickest.
Half as long.
Yeah, half as long. Twice as bright, half as long.
Yep.
And it's a really important moment where he's trying to teach him this lesson, and he should have seen what was coming. Like, he should have known that this guy was probably going to kill him.
I think he did.
Okay.
In my interpretation, because
but wasn't going to be able to fight him off.
Yeah, I think he saw him come in, because he knew that these replicants were coming back. I think he may had in his own mind had an idea of why they were coming back. And I think in that sense he saw that as soon as he walked through the door, as soon as Roy came through the door, I think he may have known.
Mm. Or even on the elevator when he's talking to him.
Yeah, I think he may have had a suspicion there.
Yeah.
But you know, definitely when he walked through the door, like, I think he knew at the end, because, you know, he would have easily been able to hit, you know, a call button to try and get security. But, you know, I think he knew that it didn't matter. If he hit the button, he would be dead so quickly
yeah.
anyway. They wouldn't get there in time.
Yeah, so he was trying to try and outwit him, I guess?
I think he was trying to empathize with him and make him and make him understand, one, why they chose to give them a 4-year lifespan,
yeah,
and also why what he has done is so incredible given that.
I don't think he was trying to make him empathize, because as we've seen, they can't. Given
no, I think Tyrell was trying to empathize with Roy.
Sure.
Not make Roy understand the empathy, but he was trying to show that he was he understood why Roy was where he was. I see.
There's also a really fascinating parallel that I'm just kind of thinking about now between the Toymaker and Tyrell, because they're both building automatons. Tyrell's building self-aware automatons, and then the Toymaker, he's a creator who builds all these toys who have no choice but to live with them and serve maybe one or two functions, basically as his playthings or
his friends, as he describes
non-intelligent
them.
Companions.
J.F. Sebastian.
J.F. Sebastian, I knew it was an S. Anyway, and then you've got Tyrell, who makes these self-aware companions that he sells, puts out into the world, who are his children, essentially. It's this god figure. And they ultimately turn against him. It's, I don't know. I haven't fully completed the loop there, but there's some really
you can
parallel.
Also see it as this the parallel of God the Creator and as someone alluded to in some of the dialogue, a fallen angel. Because one thing is the replicants are not allowed on Earth. They're illegal on Earth. They're all the off-world colonies.
Is that because they're too dangerous?
I don't remember what it's. I think it says something to that effect in the opening scroll at the beginning of it. Something that like people didn't like them. They were too human. They were scary, and so they're all in the off world and doing military work or they're doing mining or construction work, and they've now fallen. Four or five have fallen back to Earth, and so there can be a parallel between Roy as the fallen angel as Lucifer, and then. Tyrell being God, the Creator.
So then, is Deckard Jesus?
Oh, maybe.
Deckard's human. Well,
yeah. So we might as well talk about the end.
Yeah.
In the end, it's hinted that he might be a replicant.
Not even at the end. If you know what you're looking for, you can catch the first hints of that very early on, right after the talk. After he does the Voight confidence test on Rachel.
Because they talk about how she doesn't know that she's a replicant. And so you think that, oh, maybe Deckard's also replicant.
I guess I didn't think that because it's the same exact hint in The Sixth Sense when the little boy says, some don't even know they're dead.
It's not just that. There's something else more subtle that you can look at. It is photographs. Photographs are important to people. And if you notice, so Rachel comes with her photographs, very important to her. As they are that connection to this memory that she's been planted with.
He has
if you look through Deckard's apartment, he has photographs of everywhere. Also, you may notice they look rather old. I don't think there's any of them that are in color. Tend to look in black and white.
I'm liking this movie more now that we're talking about it. Because that is interesting.
Yep. And as it said, another hint is what I started to talk about earlier, the origami, the unicorn that was left on the floor by Gaff, by James Almos's character, because then that could be another connection to the dream that he has, which also interesting. I believe in the original cut, that dream didn't make it.
Really?
Yeah, the universe. I believe that was one of the ones that was. And
what is the studio doing?
And we should talk about the versions at the end because that's another interesting talk. So with that dream and then the unicorn, it could be another hint that perhaps those memories were implanted, which also could then take you back even further to the first talk with the chief, why did he do it? Well, is it a possibility that Deckard's character, if he is a replicant, was activated for this job? He's almost create one of these on a job by job basis.
that's
why he had to do it because that's what he is designed to do, and he sort of pushed that.
That's what I was thinking. But the part that makes me still question it is that with all the other replicants, and this goes back to one of the things we said before, was the eyes. They all have these like weird little orange halos going on their eyes, which you're not really sure if, like, I think the first couple of times I saw it, I thought it was like, is that just like a weird reflection or something like that? But then you never see it on any other human, but you always see it on the replicants.
So why doesn't Harrison Ford have them is correct. The question.
Yeah. And here's another thing to look at is the artist's thoughts on it. For Harrison Ford, when they were making this film and afterwards, he had considered Deckard human. However, Ridley Scott has said that he had sort of thought of him as a replicant. And then he's also alluded to more recently that Harrison Ford may have come around to that viewpoint, that he might be a replicant.
Yeah, yeah. Well, really, really the only opinion that matters is Ridley Scott's, but also the book it's based on, I guess, because that's the source material.
The author. Yeah.
And with that, I believe he's a replicant.
But again, maybe with a grain of salt, because the author's intent was also to leave it ambiguous. So it's kind of in this superposition of maybe both or neither or whatever.
Yep. And I think it is fascinating when this whole question of and which has been dealt with in other science fiction movies as well, is what makes you human? Are your memories really your memories?
Yeah. Like Westworld is a big one recently.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. That's another good example.
Definitely. And then I guess another question that I don't know if we have the answer to is, how is he able to perform that test if he is a replicant?
No, that's another interesting thing, because he doesn't answer that question. When he's asked by Rachel at one point, have you passed the Voight Kampf? And he doesn't answer yes or no in the movie. But in the book, he said yes.
Okay.
But again, in the book, as I believe he's a replicant, he could be
given the memory of passing it
when he didn't.
That's deep. I like that.
So yeah,
the photographs thing is really cool.
Yeah, there's so many layers to this.
You know,
it's all wonderful.
Well, it's really interesting that we find out that Rachel was given Tyrell's niece's memories. Makes me wonder who would Deckard's memories belong to.
I suspect that this is going to be a large subject for the next Blade Runner movie.
I hope it is.
Yep. Yep, especially since Harrison Ford is in again. Unless it's a different Deckard. Unless they bring back more. I got to say real quick.
I hope they don't try and retcon things. I really hope they don't.
Yeah, and I got to say, from the opening trailer of the new one, I do not like it.
I think it captures the feeling, but I think it kind of goes back to my...
No, bull that it does. If the opening shot in the trailer is CGI smoke...
So, okay, hold on.
No.
Oh, no. Here we go.
But real quick, I will say I love the use of miniatures in this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's a post I see a lot on certain groups on Facebook where they're like, how do you make this cool building? You just glue a bunch of crap together, paint it, spray some fog in there and light it. Boom.
Done. Yeah. And also, let's talk about versions real quick, because this is an interesting one, because there have been so many versions of it. So there was a work print prototype version, a San Diego sneak preview version, the actual U.S. theatrical release, the international theatrical release, the U.S. broadcast version, the director's cut, and the final cut.
So what's the difference between the director's cut and the final cut?
Now, this is an important one, and this was what held me off from buying a copy of it for years and years and years. The director's cut was one that had a lot of the deleted footage and the things. Like, for one example, in the original theatrical release, there was voiceover narration done by Harrison Ford.
I heard that was awful.
It's because I think the studios were fearing that the audiences wouldn't get it. They wouldn't get the world, get the setup.
And the rumor was that Harrison intentionally did it poorly.
I hope so. Yeah. So the director's cut added in took that out and added in some deleted scenes. I think that's when the unicorn first showed back into it. I think it was the director's cut. But the director's cut, despite the name, had almost zero involvement by Ridley Scott.
Hmm.
The final cut, he had complete control over.
So the director's cut wasn't actually the director's
cut. Correct.
The final cut is truly the director's cut.
Yes, which is why I got that one. That's the one you watched. Is that the one you watched too, Ben? Yeah. Yep, so that's confusing. The version I have. Yep.
That's the only version that's available on iTunes.
I'm glad they call it the final cut.
Yep.
That's the way it should be done. The way they did it for Star Wars is the way it should not be done.
Yes,
where
absolutely.
The final cut, quote unquote, is the cut no one wants.
Yep, absolutely.
But to sum up, you know, didn't know how I felt about it at first. I definitely saw a lot of awesome inspiration that it provided to other stories and video games and films. But talking about it more, I'm liking it more. You know, it's one of those films where you gotta talk about it. You gotta work through it.
Yep.
To a lesser degree, Inception was like that, where I had to kind of talk about it a little bit. But of course, it's more action oriented, so you like it more out of the gate.
Right.
It was more entertaining, but this is more of a slower, you know, film you have to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Any other final thoughts about the film, guys?
I love it. Don't fuck it up with the new one, Ridley. Like you did with Prometheus. I haven't forgotten.
I think it's an incredibly influential movie, and one that I always enjoy going back to.
Great. Yeah. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. We'll be back next time with episode 10, the big 1-0, where we'll break down a lot more awesome gear, tips, and movies.